Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
Calling all university students, immerse yourself in the ancient and medieval Roman intellectual tradition while living in the Eternal City. Apply now for our Spring 2025 Study Abroad program. The deadline is August 15th, and space is limited. Don't miss out. Apply today at thomisticinstitute.org/Rome.
The title of my talk is Friendship with a Simple God Possible? In half-hearted imitation of the scholastic practice, I'll begin by offering three objections to my giving this talk, especially at a workshop dedicated to Aquinas' account of divine simplicity. Objection one. Thomas doesn't ask whether friendship with a simple God is possible. So the process of answering this question is definitely speculative and probably messy. In reply, I grant the premise and the inference. I deny, however, that messy speculative endeavors should be avoided, especially at workshops. Why? It seems to me that one of the greatest challenges of reading and teaching St. Thomas is that his questions are already impeccably well-formed. One of the fundamental activities of doing philosophy is getting the question right. But being given a well-formed question hardly guarantees that you've gotten the question. The ordinary way that we come to get a well-formed question is by doing the dirty work of asking and trying to answer messy questions. In my experience, doing just such dirty work is one of the most fruitful ways to get to know the mind of St. Thomas. Objection two. The question, is friendship with a simple God possible, isn't directly about divine simplicity. To the extent that it's about God, it's about his activity, not his nature. And it seems like it's principally about the activity of man, and only secondarily about the activity of God. In reply, again, I grant the premises, but assert that the project is still worthwhile, especially for a workshop on divine simplicity. We come to know a thing best, not by restricting our attention to the thing in isolation, but by observing how it interacts with other things and other things with it. You hardly know a baseball bat until you've seen it interacting with a ball or flying through the air to a lucky fan. Objection three. The question is artificial. Generally speaking, artificial questions aren't worth asking. In reply, I deny the particular premise and grant the universal. Normal people, and by this, I mean those who spend their leisure time trying to catch foul balls and broken bats, and who haven't suppressed their natural instincts through misguided academic devotion. When these people read St. Thomas's proofs for the existence of God and hear et hoc dicimus Deum, and this is what we call God, they tend to ask, is this really what I mean by God? The God with whom I believe myself to be in friendship? So the question isn't artificial. In hope that there's a critical mass of normal people in the room, and in hope that there aren't any more objections to my posing the question to St. Thomas, I'll entertain a few objections to how I intend to construct Thomas's answer. My intention is to begin by constructing Aristotle's answer to the question. And to this, objection one. This is a conference on Aquinas's account of divine simplicity. Aristotle and Aquinas the philosopher are not the same. Your project seems like a bit of a bait and switch. In reply, my project will grant and seek to establish the premise that Aristotle and Thomas are most definitely not identical, even on issues about which there's significant agreement. My approach will be to assemble Thomas's answer by examining whether and where Thomas differs from Aristotle regarding what I'll call the three doctrines of the question, namely friendship, man's highest activity, and divine activity. Objection two. But why bother going through these three doctrines? Aristotle gives a straightforward answer to the question you're posing, and his reasoning is similarly straightforward. Friendship with God isn't possible, since friendship is possible only among equals, and God and man clearly aren't equals. In reply, Aristotle's answer and basic reasoning is well known, but I'm convinced that his reasoning merits further examination. In Book 7 of the Ethics, Aristotle states that, quote, when a wide disparity arises between two friends, they no longer remain, nor indeed expect to remain friends. When one becomes very remote from the other, as God is remote from man, it can continue no longer, close quote. Further on and elsewhere, though, Aristotle indicates that friendship can exist between unequals, such as between a father and a son. The inequality between father and son, he says, can be equalized, as it were, by each loving the other in proportion to his ability and in proportion to the other's excellence. Subsequent to these claims, Aristotle likens the love that a son has for his father to the love that men have for the gods. So it seems like the inequality can't be the end of the whole story. It can't be the only reason behind Aristotle's claim that friendship with God is impossible. It seems to me that the best place to look for the fuller story is in his account of the three doctrines that comprise the question. And again, that's friendship, the highest human activity, and divine activity. Objection 3. Well and good for pulling in a foil to Timus's account of these doctrines, but why Aristotle? In reply, it makes sense to choose Aristotle for discerning Thomas's answer because foils are most effective when they're most similar to the target. You understand more of what a brownie is when you try to distinguish it from dense chocolate cake than when you try to distinguish it from a baseball bat. Aristotle's account of God in Metaphysics Lambda, or Metaphysics 12, is remarkably similar to Thomas's account of divine simplicity, both in the Summa and in the Contra Gentiles. Both thinkers base their account of divine simplicity on the principle that God is pure act without any potency, or for Aristotle, energeia without dynamis. Thomas himself even signals this similarity by referring to Metaphysics 12 in his account of the existence of God, which immediately precedes his account of divine simplicity. So, in hope that your objections to the whether, who, and how of my paper have been answered, I'd like, as a final task of this introduction, to clarify the paper's what, that is, the question itself. I'll abandon the objection and reply format and follow instead the approach that Thomas takes in his account of divine simplicity, namely, by denying of the question everything that can't be truly said of it. There are three terms that I wish to clarify: friendship, simple God, and possible. Regarding what I mean by friendship, first, I'm not asking about God's side of the friendship, but about man's side. I'm not asking whether a simple God can love man, but whether man can love a simple God. My question, in other words, isn't so much about natural theology as about what we might call the religious act. Second, I'm not asking whether man can love God as for man's sake, but whether man can love God for God's sake. Whether man can want what is good for God and conceive of himself as somehow contributing to that good. In Aristotle's language, I'm asking whether man can love God with the love of perfect friendship, and not merely as something useful or pleasant. In Thomas's language, I'm asking whether man can love God with friendship love, and not merely with concupiscible love. Third, I'm not asking simply whether man can perform external acts that are directed at God, acts that could be construed as pious or dutiful. It's obvious that man can perform external acts directed at God. What's not obvious is whether we can perform these acts not merely out of a sense of obligation or fear of not doing so, but out of a rational attraction to God as good, not only for me, but good in himself. Regarding what I mean by simple God, first, I don't mean a theological conception of God. I'm not asking about the possibility of friendship with God insofar as he has revealed himself by some special revelation, and who nonetheless remains simple in his divine nature. Second, I'm not asking about whether Aristotle or his contemporaries thought about the gods, about the deities of Homer and Greek mythology. Aristotle mentions these deities on occasion, but regards them in a very different light than the god whose nature and existence can be established by rational argumentation. My question is about the possibility of having friendship love with God in this sense, with the God of the philosophers, as Pascal says. Regarding what I mean by possible, I'm not asking whether it's psychologically possible for man to have friendship love toward a simple God. This is an empirical question, and its answer, provided that it's epistemically possible for man to form a conception of a simple God, is obviously yes. Even if how isn't so obvious. I'm also not asking whether Aristotle or Thomas thought that man was psychologically capable of having friendship love toward a simple God. This is a historical question, and I don't think its answer matters very much, especially at a workshop on divine simplicity. I am asking is whether, according to St. Thomas, having friendship love for the God of the philosophers is reasonable, given what man is, what God is, and what friendship is. I'm asking, in other words, principally about the ontological ground of friendship. Lastly, and as a bonus, what do I mean by giving an answer to this question? I don't mean to set forth an argument or to assert a likely account. What I mean to do is tell a story about how Thomas's take on the three doctrines might hang together. Stories, much more than arguments and accounts, are worthwhile just so long as they might be true, even if they happen not to be. Without further ado, section one, Aristotle's answer. Part one, friendship. Throughout the Nicomachean Ethics and the Eudemian Ethics, Aristotle lists several marks of friendship. Not all of these marks are equally essential to friendship. Some of the marks flow from others. In order to keep this talk under 3 hours, I'll list the marks and then briefly make the case that they can be reduced to two. The marks of friendship, in no particular order, but numbered just to give the appearance of order, are as follows. In order to be a friend to someone else, first, I must not merely wish that the other possess what is good for him, but also must act upon this wish. Acting upon the wish that another possess what is good is what Aristotle means by love. Note that love is a necessary condition of being a friend, but not sufficient. It's possible to love someone without being his friend, but it's not possible to be someone's friend without loving him. Second, I must be pleased by the presence and the existence of the other. To be pleased, here, means that I regard the other as good, and I take notice of this goodness. In a less-than-perfect friendship, being pleased means primarily that I regard the other as good for me. While in a perfect friendship, being pleased means that I regard the other as good in his own right, and therefore as also good for me to be around. Third, I must be pleased and pained by the same things that please and pain the other. From my perspective, this is one of the most easily recognizable marks that allows us to differentiate between being a friend from simply performing an act of love. It's possible for a Yankee fan to love a Red Sox fan, but it's impossible for a Yankee fan to be a friend of a Red Sox fan, since they're not pleased and pained alike. This example limps, but it's more interesting than talking about differences in character, which is what Aristotle is really referring to. And I'm certainly not insinuating anything about the character of Red Sox fans. Four, I must regard my friend as another self. This mark seems to follow from, or to recapitulate, the marks previously mentioned. And Aristotle says as much. To be a friend to another is to act toward that other just as I act toward myself. Five, I must be, in some sense, my friend's equal. Aristotle is saying something slightly different here than that the other is another self. Unless I am in some respects equal to someone, I won't be interacting with him in common activities. There, accordingly, won't be any opportunities for me to act on my wish that he possess his good. A fortiori, unless I interact with someone in a common activity, I won't come to know his character, what pleases and pains him, and what his baseball affiliation is. Six, I must live with or live near my friend, at least some of the time. Aristotle offers this as a qualified condition, saying that occasional distance doesn't destroy one's ability to be a friend, which she regards as a kind of habit, but only the active exercise of the habit. The exercise of being a friend, again, is acting for his good. And this, at least in Aristotle's day, required being physically with someone. 7. I must regard myself as part of my friend's good. This is another mark that allows us to distinguish between being a friend from merely loving another. I can act for the good of the Red Sox fan without believing that my presence is good for him and pleasant to him. Most likely, it's my absenting myself from the Red Sox fan that's for his good. It seems to me that these 7 marks can be reduced to 2 in the following way. I will have friendship love towards someone on the conditions that I am aware of the other as another self, and that I act on my wish that the other possess his good. The first condition, that I be aware of the other as another self, includes 5 of the other marks. Another self would be pleased and pained by what pleases and pains me. Another self would be pleased by my existence. Another self would live with me so as to be able to engage in common activity, which in turn would allow me to know this other self and to potentially act for his good. Another self would be equal to me, and another self would regard himself as good for me, just as I regard my own self as good. The second condition, that I act on my wish that the other possess his good, stands alone. So, for Aristotle, I will have friendship love for another if I am aware of the other as another self, and if I act on my wish that the other possess his good. Turning now to Aristotle's account of the activity of the would-be friend of God. Part 2. Contemplation, the highest human activity. At the end of the Ethics, Aristotle makes the case that the highest life is the theoretical life, or the life of the mind, a life whose culminating act is contemplation. That life is highest, he says, which is most pleasant and self-sufficient. Something is most pleasant if it's desirable for its own sake and not for anything beyond itself. Something is self-sufficient if it can be sustained without anything extrinsic to itself. For reasons that you might anticipate, but that we'll note in a few minutes anyway, Aristotle calls a life that is both pleasant and self-sufficient divine. Aristotle then proceeds to show that the activity of contemplation is both self-sufficient and most pleasant. Contemplation is most self-sufficient, he says, because the contemplator doesn't need anything to get going, as it were, other than his native wisdom. Contemplation is most pleasant, among other reasons, because we can contemplate almost continuously, and thus be pleased almost continually. We might have to stop in order to eat, but even so, we can contemplate for longer periods of time than we can eat, usually at least. Contemplation is also most pleasant, since we enjoy contemplation for its own sake. Aristotle notes that this should be especially obvious, since there's no product of contemplation beyond the activity of contemplation itself. As a practical application of this insight, if you're thinking, in order to write a term paper, you're not contemplating. This is different, though, from incorporating into your term paper what you happen to be contemplating for its own sake, especially at a workshop on divine simplicity. Outside of the Ethics, Aristotle describes the activity of contemplation in its own right, rather than in the context of an argument about the life of happiness. I'll summarize what Aristotle says about human contemplative thinking in these other contexts under 3 headings. First, activity's character. 2, the activity's object, and 3, the activity's cause. First, contemplation is chiefly characterized as a restful activity. Aristotle divides activities in general into 2 kinds. Kinetic activities have some progression in them, some definite beginning, middle, and end. We might pursue these moving activities for their own sake, but one part of a kinetic activity is different from and for the sake of another part. In contrast, entelechic activities lack any sense of progression. Every part, as it were, of an entelechic activity is the complete activity. Since we pursue entelechic activities for their own sakes, we can say that we're at rest, enjoying an entelechic activity at every moment. By way of illustration, contrast looking for a dandelion in a baseball field, which is kinetic, with looking at that dandelion, which is entelechic, unless you're looking at it in order to do something with it, like whacking it with a baseball bat. This qualification brings us to another feature of contemplation. Aristotle uses a different pair of words to distinguish between the kind of thinking activity that moves and the kind of thinking activity that rests. He uses this to show that contemplative thinking isn't just restful in the sense of not being for anything else. It's also restful in the activity of the mind itself. We think dianoetically, that is to say discursively, when we are thinking things through. We think things through whenever our attention moves from one thing or one aspect to another. If we wish to think either of or about things that have parts, we must think dianoetically. We can't listen to or think of the tune, "Take Me Out to the Ball Game," without moving our attention through the parts. Since there's motion involved in dianoetic thinking, we can, at least theoretically, be aware when we're thinking of the passage of time. In contrast, we think noetically, that's to say non-discursively, when we're resting our attention on one thing simply. We're not thinking anything about that thing, but only thinking of it. To rest our attention on the thing is to think the thing as a whole, without running through its parts. As long as we're resting our attention on this, we're unaware of the passage of time, because there's no variation in our thinking to mark one now from another. What then is the object of contemplative thinking? What is it then that can be thought noetically without moving one's attention from part to part? Rather than running through the long list of things that can't be thought noetically, I'll restrict myself to mentioning the one thing that concerns this present project. Even though God is simple, we can't think of him in a simple manner. Aristotelian contemplation is not the contemplation of God. Contemplation's objects, rather, are the singular formal material composites that we encounter in our everyday experience. This squirrel, this activity of running. Only these objects are sufficiently present to us for us to be able to think them without having to construct the object first. There's more to the story, though. Recall from the Ethics that contemplation is both self-sufficient and most pleasant. It seems, though, that thinking of this squirrel isn't either self-sufficient or overwhelmingly pleasant. In order to think of the squirrel, I need to have experienced it in some manner, and I certainly don't regard this squirrel as my greatest good. Is the Aristotle of the Ethics contradicting the Aristotle of the De Anima? Enter the Aristotle of the Metaphysics, who says, no. The resolution of the apparent conflict consists in noting that whenever we think, we are also able to think of our thinking. Mind, we might say, is able to mind itself, if and only if it is minding something else. Or, as one commentator puts it, we could never understand ourselves simply by turning our intellectual gaze inward. I'll omit Aristotle's account of why this is so, and quote instead the Aristotle of the Metaphysics. Quote, mind thinks itself through participation in the object of thought, for it becomes an object of thought in coming into contact with and thinking its objects. This actuality is the divine element which thought seems to contain. Close quote. The object of human contemplation, then, is twofold. Secondarily, we contemplate the singular things that we encounter and experience. This is secondary because we do so in order that we might contemplate our own thinking, namely the most divine element in us. Such an activity seems fairly self-sufficient, but it does have two causes external to itself. First, as we've already seen, my self-contemplation requires that I be thinking of something other than myself. So this squirrel is a cause of my self-contemplation. Unsurprisingly, Aristotle doesn't believe that a squirrel is a sufficient cause for contemplation. Surprisingly, to the question, why do we bother thinking at all? Aristotle replies, the starting point of thinking is not thinking, but something greater. What then could be greater, even than knowledge and intellect, but God? The act of thinking, as well as every other act of being, is undertaken ultimately out of desire for God. Each thing strives to imitate the life of God, and in doing so, each thing becomes what it is. Each thing, we might say, just is its imitation of God's own activity. Part 3. the activity of God. Aristotle discusses divine activity in the same places where he discusses human contemplation. His most extended discussion occurs in Metaphysics 12, immediately after he establishes the existence of, quote, a principle whose very substance is activity, which is eternal and unmovable and separate from sensible things, without parts and indivisible, close quote. This should sound familiar, especially at a workshop dedicated to divine simplicity. Aristotle composes his account of the activity of God on the premise that no potentiality can be in God. He must be actually thinking eternally. There can be no progression or development in his understanding. And he cannot think of anything except the greatest of things. For if he thought of anything less, there would be some potential for his being more pleased. But this can't be the case with God. Aristotle concludes, "It must be itself that thought thinks, since it is the most excellent of things, and its thinking is a thinking on thinking. God, that is to say, is at once the subject who thinks, the activity of thinking, and the object thought. And this, according to Aristotle, is all that God does. He doesn't create the cosmos. The cosmos has always existed. He does cause the cosmos to be eternally ordered, but he does so by being loved and not by any act of will." Commentators are divided as to whether Aristotle's God has some awareness of the cosmos or not. Does he contemplate himself only, or does he contemplate the cosmos as he contemplates himself? One argument in favor of God's knowing the cosmos is predicated on the analogy between human thinking and divine thinking. The human mind can't think itself unless it simultaneously thinks of something else. If the analogy between human thinking and divine thinking is thoroughgoing, then God must eternally think the cosmos as a whole in order to think himself. I'm unconvinced by this argument, first, because Aristotle states outright in the Eudemian Ethics that God is, quote, too perfect to think of anything else besides himself, close quote. Second, because it seems ad hoc to insist that the analogy between divine and human thinking must be thoroughgoing. Aristotle's contention is that human thinking imitates divine thinking, not that it is divine thinking. We have, at long last, Aristotle's take on the three doctrines of our question. The final task of this Aristotelian section of the story is to see how the three doctrines fit together. Our goal, once again, is to discern Aristotle's reasons for giving a no answer to the question as to whether it's possible for man to love God as a friend. Recall that man can be a friend to another on two conditions. First, that he's aware of the other as another self, and second, that he acts on his wish that the other possesses good. So, first, can man be aware of God as another self? The answer here seems to me to be a qualified yes. It's undeniable that man and God are pleased by the same thing, namely contemplation. Man enjoys, intermittently and by thinking of the things in experience, the delight of self-contemplation that God enjoys eternally and directly. It's also undeniable that human mind and its activity are similar to God and his activity, similar enough, perhaps, to regard one as another self. Things begin to get shaky, though, when it comes to how the average Joe or the average Sosthenes would come to recognize his similarity to God. Is there a common activity in which man and God engage as equals, or at least as proportionate equals? Contemplation seems to be the closest thing to a common activity, but there are two problems with pointing to contemplation as the activity in which man becomes aware of his similarity to God. First, as mentioned above, God isn't an object of man's contemplation, so man can't encounter God in this way. Second, since man doesn't contemplate with God, he also can't encounter God in this way. In educational terms, the contemplation of God and man is parallel play rather than playing with. As far as I can tell, the only way that man would be able to recognize God as similar to himself is through reflecting on his own contemplative activity as an image, so to speak, of God's activity. What about the second condition? Can man act on his wish that God possesses good? The answer here, as above, seems to me to be a qualified yes. Presuming the fulfillment of the first question, that man would come to recognize in his own activity of contemplation his similarity to God. There seems to be no problem with man also recognizing contemplation to be the good that both he and God enjoy. And having recognized this, there only seems to be a slight problem with man's wishing that God continue to enjoy the good of contemplation. God cannot not enjoy the good of contemplation, so there seems to be no need for wishing him well. It becomes more problematic when we consider how man could act on this curious wish. The best candidate seems to be, unsurprisingly, contemplation. In engaging in the activity that is, analogically, God's good, man advances that good. This is a weak candidate, though, for two reasons. First, imitating God isn't obviously contributing to God's self-sufficient good. Second, Aristotle nowhere indicates that man's imitation of God is in any way for God. Each thing's imitation is for itself. Its imitation is its own good. We've landed in a precarious position. From our analysis of the three doctrines, it seems that Aristotle is entitled to a tentative yes to the question of whether man can reasonably love God as a friend. Aristotle's forthright answer, though, is an unambiguous no. To what can we attribute this difference? Here are three guesses, more than one of which might be true at the same time. First, perhaps Aristotle's unambiguous no and the yes to which he's entitled are answers to different questions. Full friendship, involving mutual and recognized love between God and man, is impossible. But it may still be possible for man to be a friend to God. Second, perhaps Aristotle's unambiguous no isn't about the possibility of friendship with God per se, but about whether friendship with God is supportive of a life of human happiness. Friendship with thinking supports neither a life of virtue nor one's ability to contemplate, while friendship with another Sosthenes does both of these things. And third, perhaps Aristotle believed that neither full friendship with nor being a friend to God was possible, precisely because these so-called friendships don't manifestly fulfill friendship's two conditions, for reasons displayed above. St. Thomas, or rather we, have our work cut out for us. Section 2, Thomas's answer. Our plan here, as before, will be to walk through the three doctrines of friendship, the highest human activity, and divine activity. This time, though, we'll note not the whole of what Thomas says about each doctrine, but only how he differs significantly from Aristotle. If all goes according to plan, the differences between Aristotle and Thomas on these doctrines ought to give us a clue as to Thomas's reasoned answer to the question of whether man can be a friend to God. Part 1, friendship. In none of the places where Thomas discusses friendship do we find him outright rejecting any of the aspects of the Aristotelian account. Thomas distinguishes his account from Aristotle's by introducing some new terminology. One distinction and one term. The new terminology doesn't constitute a strict departure from Aristotle, but it does seem to facilitate a subtly different emphasis. The distinction Thomas introduces is between friendship love and concupiscence love. That which is loved with friendship love, Thomas says, is loved simply and for itself. Whereas that which is loved with concupiscence love is loved not simply and for itself, but for something else. We love wine, Thomas observes, because we wish ourselves and our friends to have good wine. But we don't wish the wine to have good things for its own sake. Unless we're very drunk, I might add. Wine is not a woman's best friend. If all we have for someone is concupiscence love, we can't say that we're being a friend. The term that Thomas introduces is communication. Thomas employs this term in the context of explaining what's necessary for wishing someone well, which in turn is necessary for being a friend. It's impossible to wish someone well, he says, unless there's some kind of communication. What Thomas seems to mean here isn't that my would-be friend must talk to me, but that my would-be friend must somehow reveal to me his life, his way of being. There must be, Thomas says, some communication of life, which requires that I and my would-be friend live together. My reading of this is as follows. I must come to know what my would-be friend regards as good, and thus whether I'm similar to him or not. I must do this, however, not by concluding these things from argumentation, but by living with him and thus perceiving them. This seems to be what Aristotle meant by insisting that friendship is impossible between unequals. But Thomas says it better. Part 2. Contemplation as the highest human activity. Here, as with the doctrine of friendship, Thomas subtracts nothing from Aristotle's account and adds only new terminology. I say only not to downplay the significance or the volume of the new terminology. Thomas and his fellow scholastics found room enough in Aristotle's raw Greek for an abundance of clarifying distinctions. I'll pass over all of these, save for two. First, in De Anima 3.5, Aristotle distinguishes between the activities and features of the mind that makes all things, on the one hand, and the mind that becomes all things, on the other. Thomas, following the Arabic commentators, calls these two activities of mind agent intellect and potential intellect. Thomas invokes the distinction exponentially more than Aristotle does. As far as the doctrine of contemplation goes, Thomas uses the distinction to specify, first, that it's man's potential intellect that he thinks when he thinks about his thinking, and second, that it's in respect of his agent intellect, which is always an act, that man is most similar to God. The second distinction that Thomas brings to Aristotle's account of contemplation is familiar to us already. Thomas specifies that what initiates contemplation, what moves man to contemplate, is an act of love for God as man's final end. Thomas describes this love not as imitation, but as concupiscence love. That is, as the love of God for man's sake. Accordingly, if the only reason why I engage in contemplation is out of concupiscence love for God, my act of contemplation isn't an act of friendship love. Part 3, the activity of God. At last, we've come upon an Aristotelian doctrine concerning which Thomas has more than merely new terminology to offer. I'm not referring to the essence-existence distinction, whose explanatory power pertains more to God's nature than to the character of his activity ad intra. I'm referring rather to Thomas's account of God's activity as an exemplar cause of the world. In his commentary on Aristotle's Metaphysics, Thomas goes beyond his role as commentator as follows. Quote, "We must bear in mind that the philosopher's aim is to show that God does not understand something else but only himself. It does not follow, however, that all things different from himself are not known by him. For by understanding himself, he knows all other things." Close quote. Those are not Aristotle's words. This is possible, Thomas explains, because God is the principle upon which the world, as an effect, depends. Since effects are, in a manner, contained in their causes, God, in knowing himself as a principle, also knows his effects. Thomas is echoing here something he also said in his commentary on Aristotle's De Anima 3.6. Quote, "The divine mind must have itself for its primary and immediate object, and it must know all other things in knowing itself." Thus, without denying that God is a final cause, which all things desire and perhaps imitate, Thomas adds that God is also an efficient exemplar cause of the world. This seems to be a particularly significant part of the story, since it gives a different account of why there exists a similarity between the activity of God and man. In Aristotle's case, the cause of the similarity is located exclusively in man's imitation of God. We're similar to God because we love and thus seek to imitate him, and not because God loves us. In Thomas's case, the cause of the similarity is located primarily in God, and only secondarily in our imitation of him. It's only because we're already similar to God that we're able to make ourselves more like him through imitation. How do all these pieces fit together? In brief, I don't know. Since it wasn't entirely clear either whether or why Aristotle denies that man can be a friend to God, even an impeccably clear account of how Thomas departs from Aristotle on these three doctrines wouldn't give us a clear yes or no from Thomas. So, I don't know. But I do have a guess, a reasoned guess, that involves noticing not just how Thomas departs from Aristotle on the three doctrines, but how Thomas's departures fit together into a story, as it were, of their own. Recall that Thomas departs from Aristotle in these three ways. Concerning the doctrine of friendship, Thomas emphasizes that we can only be a friend to another if the other has in some manner communicated himself to us. We receive this communication, this self-revelation, not as the conclusion of an argument, but by perceiving the other, by living with him. Concerning human contemplation, Thomas notes that what moves man to contemplate is concupiscence love for God. Such love isn't friendship love, so it neither requires nor effects any kind of communication on the part of God to us. And concerning divine contemplation, Thomas asserts that in knowing himself as a principle, God knows all things. That is to say, God as exemplar cause is the cause of our similarity with him, because effects resemble their causes. In some manner, our very being communicates to us something of what God is like. Bringing these pieces together, tentatively, Thomas might have reasoned thus. In order to be a friend to God, God must be present to me, to communicate to me his good and thus his similarity to me. This communication can't be achieved simply by my imitating God's activity. Engaging in similar activities might make me like God, but this likeness alone won't produce the requisite communication of similarity. However, since God is the exemplar cause of my activity, God is, in a manner, communicated to me in my own activity. He dwells in me, as it were, as the principle of my being. If I could perceive this by thinking of my own thinking, it seems possible that I could love God as a friend. I'd like to close with one more act of wild speculation concerning just one aspect of one of the doctrines that we've examined. Aristotle and Thomas alike regard contemplation to be the highest human activity. They concur that it's desire that sets this activity in motion, but they seem to differ as to the nature of that desire. For Aristotle, the reason why we think or do anything is the desire to be like God. For Thomas, we're motivated not so much by the desire to be like God, but to be with him, to be in union with the object of our desire. This small difference might make the difference between a no answer from Aristotle and a yes from Thomas. Both grant that friendship is possible wherever there is both the desire and a possibility for union, for living together, because of and in order to continue to enjoy some likeness. With respect to our friendship with God, Aristotle believes that the desire isn't there, and Thomas believes it is. Why this difference? Why do Aristotle and Thomas differ as regards the nature of human desire in relation to God? My hunch is that it lies in an uncharacteristic move on Aristotle's part, namely of beginning his inquiry into human desire for God, not with reflection on experience, but with an abstract requirement. Aristotle arrives at his account of human desire for God as an answer to a question concerning God as primary being. God is eternal and unmoved, so how do temporal, moved beings relate to God? It seems to me that if Aristotle had started or supplemented his inquiry into human desire for God with experience, as he does in his account of friendship, he would have arrived at a different and fuller account. Perhaps he might have seen that, alongside our desire to be like God, we also desire, or can desire, to be with him.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.